Okay, let's get ready for the Torah portion. So if you got your Bibles at hand, turn to the end, pretty close to the end anyway, of the third chapter of the book of Devarim, or Deuteronomy in English. And we'll pick it up there right after the last portion ends, the first one here in Devarim, that says, we're not to fear these people in the land, for you, Yahuwah your God, your Elohim, it is he that fights for you. And it is that at that time that Moshe then says that he besought, Vayet Hanan, and I besought, I went before, literally on his knees, basically, at that time saying, O Yahuwah, you have begun to show your servant your greatness and your strong hand. What Elohim is there in heaven or on earth that can do the things that you do, your mighty acts? So, he says, please, let me go over. Let me see the good land that is beyond the Jordan, the goodly hill country, and Lebanon. But he says, no, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was wroth. He was angry with me for your sakes. He didn't listen to me. Now, let's pause there, because a whole lot has been made about this in the Midrash. As a matter of fact, this is probably one of the most, you'd think, at least from the amount of discussion on it, confusing sections of the portion. And indeed, one of the more perplexing parts of Scripture. Because here is Moshe. And essentially, the way the story goes is, look, if this guy isn't going to go into the land, what hope do the rest of us have? Arguably, he's the greatest prophet so far as modern rabbinic Judaism is concerned of all. He brought the Torah. And if he doesn't get to go in the land, really, you know, how else could anybody possibly hope to measure up? So, this is difficult. He was wroth with me, it says, for your sakes. We're told elsewhere that he hit the rock. He wasn't supposed to hit the rock, and he hit it twice. He was supposed to speak to it once. So he clearly blew that particular picture. The rest of this portion and the things that have kind of led up to it seem to indicate, well, maybe there is a little bit more to it. What I'm trying to do is just to say I'm gonna summarize all of that in a way that, to me at least, makes sense. If you think there's a greater explanation that's necessary, and I don't doubt that there is, but at least when I look at it and say, okay, let's come up with Occam's razor, the simplest solution that seems to fit. What is going on? Why doesn't Moshe get to go into the land? And I'm gonna mention a phrase that appears in a number of places in Scripture. One of them is that Yeshua paraphrases it. And it goes something like this: to whom much is given, much is expected. Moshe spoke with Elohim. To whom much is given, much is expected. And so there's no question about it. He is held to a higher standard. And the other side of the argument about how, you know, if he can't be worthy, how can any of us, would boil down to, on the other hand, if he can't get it right, given what he was given and the access that he had to the Most High, well, then what? So he was held to a very, very high standard, no doubt about it. Verse 26 says, he didn't listen to me, he did not hearken to me. And Yahuwah then said to me, and I'm going to paraphrase this the first time. I'll read it from the King James in a second. Hey, don't you get it? Isn't that enough? Let it suffice to you. Speak no more unto me of this matter. The rest of the Midrash basically boils down to, look, you have so much. Look at what you have done in your life. Look at what has been done through you. Let that suffice you. And then he's told, get up to the top of Mount Pisgah. Lift up your eyes to the west, to the north, to the south, and to the east. And you'll behold, you will see with your own eyes, but you're not going to go over this Jordan River. Instead, give a charge unto Yahushua. Encourage him, strengthen him. He is the one that's going to go over before his people. He will cause them to inherit the land that you will see. So says Moshe, we abode in the valley over against Beth Peor. And now Israel, hearken. Now this is where I'm going to start doing something that I know, if you've heard me talk about this portion before, you've heard me emphasize the very same things. And you're going to hear me emphasize them for the very same reasons that I emphasize them every year. Well, several of them. One, because Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh does. Because he says that this stuff is important. How do you know it's important? Well, for one, he repeats it over and over and over again. Two, we can look at the terminology, the words that he uses here, and recognize that they're very specific. And that certain words keep appearing over and over and over again. I'm going to name three of them in this verse 1 of chapter 4. Statutes, ordinances, oh, and then this one. Do. Do. So, hearken, shamar, right? Listen and obey, hear and obey. Hearken to what? Well, the hukim, that's the statutes. We know these words, hukim, mishpatim, mitzvot. Hearken to the statutes and the ordinances, ha mishpatim, which I teach you, said Moshe, and then do them. This do part is really, really important. And the sages rightfully get it and note that it does get emphasized over and over and over again. If you love me, keep my commandments. John 14:15. We need to be able to say, look, it's not enough. This is one of the things that really so irritates me, I guess, about Waystream ex-Chianity, and I'll use that term in this context. Oh, just say the sinner's prayer. Get your get-out-of-hell-free card, and then, you know, you can hold it up if you want to right before the bus hits you, but you don't have to do anything. Well, that's one of the bigger lies in all of paganized Christianity. They do tend to ignore some of the other verses in there, like, show me your faith by your works. You say you believe? Oh, great. Show me. Do. Moshe adds a little bit more to it in verse 1 here. He says, do these statutes and ordinances which I teach you, that you may live, and then go in and possess the land which Yahuwah, Elohim of your fathers, gives you. Well, we know a couple of things. A, we haven't been taught this anymore. We've been told it doesn't matter anymore. Oh, all that law stuff's done away with anyway. And B, maybe that's why it is that we're still in exile and not in the land. Verse 2 is one that I probably quote, I don't know, maybe just about every day. I'm sure I quote this hundreds of times a year. It also is repeated in chapter 12 of this same book here, and we'll emphasize it again when we get there. And by the way, this is also, if you want to look in the book of Revelation, it's what I will sometimes refer to, not completely tongue-in-cheek, as the very last commandment in Scripture. It's at the very, very end of the book of Revelation. It says here, you are not to add unto the debar, the word which I command you, nor are you to take away from it, that you may keep the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka, which I command you. There's that word again. Hear and obey. Keep, shamar, guard. Because your eyes have seen what Yahuwah did in Baal Peor, for the men that followed the Baals, that so-called Lord. He has destroyed them from the midst of you. But you cleave, and you did even cleave unto every... I'm sorry, let me try this again. You that did cleave, all of you who did this, who listened, who followed, who obeyed, are alive today. That can't be said of all kinds of other folks that aren't with them when they were hearing these words. Behold, says Moshe again, here comes the very same words one more time. Behold, I have taught you statutes and ordinances, hukim, mishpatim, even as Yahuwah, my Eloah, commanded me that you should go do so in the midst of the land that you go in to possess. And here is where Rashi emphasizes, In the Hebraic mindset, there's an understanding. And we're going to see this literally appear. It's going to flow off the pages of this Torah portion. The essence of wisdom. Okay, it's a good thing to study Torah. But the essence of wisdom is to do it. And along with that, there's also an attitude that says when you teach it, that too is a doing kind of thing, to teach his instruction. And that's, of course, what Moshe is doing here as well. So therefore, verse 6, observe, shamar, and do, for this is your wisdom. Okay, there you go. This is where Rashi gets it. To do is the very essence of wisdom. And your understanding in the sight of the peoples, the nations. So that when they hear all of these statutes, they'll say, surely, this really is a great nation and a wise and understanding people. Because they will see that it's not that you merely talk the talk, if you want to put it in the modern parlance, but you also walk the walk that you do. For what other kind of great nation is there that has got their Elohim so nigh unto them as our Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is, whensoever we call upon him? What great nation is there that has statutes and ordinances as righteous, Zadikim, as all of this Torah, which I set before you this day? Now, this is another one of those places where I make this distinction. The English in the King James says, as righteous as all of this law, ha Torah. And again, I don't suggest that that's horribly wrong, it's just incomplete. Instruction is bigger than just merely the law itself. Take heed to yourself, keep your soul diligent, lest you forget these things that you have seen with your own eyes, lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and then you fail to make them known to your children's children. So that's what we need to do. Make them known to your children and to your children's children. In the day that you stood before Yahuwah Eloheka in Horeb, and he said to me, assemble these people, I'll make them hear my words, that they can learn to fear me all the days that they live upon the earth, and that they may teach your children. Now, one more time. Assemble, learn to fear me, and teach your children what? Statutes and ordinances. How do you teach them? Best way? By showing them, by doing them. All of these, in other words, are very much action-oriented words. That's the essence of what we're seeing here, is it's a very action-oriented teaching. Y'all came near and you stood under the mountain. Mountain burned with fire, cloud, thick darkness, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the voice of words, but you didn't see a form, only a voice. And he declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even the Debarim, the ten of them, the ten words that were written upon those two tablets of stone. And he commanded me at that time to teach you what? Same words, statutes and ordinances, hukim, mishpatim, that you might, say it with me please, do these in the land that you go over to possess. Now remember, take heed. You did not see any manner of form on the day that he spoke to you out of the fire in Horeb, Mount Sinai, in other words. Now, the next four verses are going to make an interesting point. And if you read them kind of fast, it's easy to miss this. Because what he's going to talk about is this idea, and we're going to see it repeated again. Repetition, repetition. Did I say repetition? In the Ten Commandments that are going to come up and be repeated here as well. This command against making a graven image, an idol, the likeness of any beast on the earth, or winged fowl in the heaven, or anything that creeps on the ground, or any fish in the waters. What has that got to do with the fact that he says twice here, take heed, you didn't see a form. He just spoke to you. You just heard Debarim words. And it's that. It's this idea that he's pointing out, look, when he spoke to you, when the real, one true God spoke to you, you heard the words. Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of Yah. There's a verse there that some of you may recognize. You heard the words. You did not see a form. And then what's he going to do? He's going to warn them against trying to substitute a form and say, oh, I got to see a form and I don't believe it. At one of the most important events in history, there was no form. There was only the words. You heard his word. No form. So don't fall into the trap of thinking you have to make some form and look at it or worship it. Verse 19, lest you lift up your eyes to heaven when you see all of these things, sun, moon, stars, the host of heaven, that you can be drawn away and worship them and serve them. But you have been brought forth out of the iron furnace, out of Mitzrayim, to be unto him a people, just as you are this day. Now, he was angry with me for your sakes, Moshe reminds him again. He swore, I'm not going to get to go over the Jordan, go into that good land. I'm going to have to die here. Woe is me, right? I'm not going to go over. But you are going to go over and possess that good land. So what? He repeats the message again. I'm not going to go with you. Take heed, lest you forget the covenant that he made with you. And do what it is that he has forbidden you to do, that you make some kind of graven image, the likeness of anything that he has forbidden you. For he is a devouring fire, a jealous Elohim. When you beget children and grandchildren, you will have been a long time in the land. If you begin to deal corruptly, you make a graven image, the form of anything, to do that which is evil in his sight, to provoke him. Well, says Moshe, I'm going to call these two witnesses that we keep seeing show up as well, heaven and earth, Hashemayim Vayet Ha'aretz, to witness against you this day. It is not going to work out well. You will utterly perish, and soon, from off the land that you go over the Jordan to possess. Your days will not be prolonged upon it, but you will utterly be destroyed. And he will do exactly what we now see in history did happen. We have been scattered. For the most part, folks, most of us don't even know what our heritage is. We don't know which sets of the 10 tribes we have the blood coursing in our veins from. Because we've been scattered. We're literally all over the place. And that's exactly what he's warning would happen here. He will scatter you among the peoples. You'll be left few in number among the nations where he has led you away. And there you will go serve those other gods. All right, we're going to talk about this in the news, but one of the things I keep pointing out, it doesn't take much effort to look at the United States, American Idol, to look at the Supreme Court, the 9 black robe priests of another god, to look at what is not allowed in the schools. Boy Scouts this week said, oh, we're going to have gay scoutmasters. Let's have a little bit of abuse going on there in the troops. Yeah. Talk about serving other gods and not allowing him in. Well, not only have we been scattered, check, just as promised, but serve other gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone that you don't see nor hear nor eat nor smell. No, they can't do any of that stuff. But from there, here comes some comfort, like Isaiah, the Haftorah portion for tonight. From there you will, and indeed, folks, we are seeking Yahuwah Eloheka. And you shall find him. What does it say? Literally, seek, and ye shall find. If, here comes the caveat, you search after him with all your heart and with all your soul. In your distress, when all of these things are come upon you. Now listen to this. I have been amazed over the years as we go through the Torah portion. It never seems to fail that what we will see happening in the world, if we're paying attention to the times and the seasons around us, and what we see in the Torah portion and the Scripture just seems to fit like a glove. There's so much that we can take out of this. Well, here is yet another one of those places where the bell ought to be ringing loudly. It says, in your distress, when all of these things have come upon you, in the end of days. Are we in the end of days, or are we just kind of so close we can smell them? In the end of days, you will return to Yahuwah Eloheka, and you will shamar, hearken, bekolo, to his voice. For he is, in fact, merciful. He will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant that he swore unto your fathers. For ask now. Since the day that Elohim created man upon the earth, from one end of the heavens to the other, has there ever been such a thing as great as this? Has there ever been anything even heard like this? Did a people, says Moshe, ever hear the voice of Elohim speaking out of the midst of the fire? as you've heard and live? Nation, ever been assayed to go like what he has done? To be taken out of another nation by trials, signs, and wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, according to all the things that he did for you and me, terrain before your eyes? All of this so that you might know, and it's in the first person in Exodus, Ani Yahuwah, that he is who he says he is. Out of the heavens he made you to hear his voice, that he might instruct you. Upon the earth he made you to see his great fire, and you heard his words, Devarim, out of the midst of the fire. Because he loved your fathers, and he chose their seed, and he brought you out with his presence and great power to drive out nations bigger, tougher, stronger, meaner than you, greater and mightier than you, to bring you in and to give you their land for your inheritance, just as it is this day. To know this day, to put it in your heart, that Yahuwah, he is El, in Hashemayim above and upon Ha'aretz below, there is no other. So what's the takeaway from all of this? You already know what's going to be here, don't you, right? You shall keep, Shamar, his statutes, Hukim, this is actually Hukim, they're his in this case, and his Mishpatim, commandments, which I command you this day. So it'll go well with you and with your children after you, and that you can prolong your days upon the land that he's given you forever. All right, then Moshe separates some more cities beyond the Jordan toward the sun rising. The cities of refuge for the manslayer, they're named here, Beser for the Reubenites, Ramot in Gilead for the Gadites, and Golan in Bashan for the Manassehites. And this, it says, is HaTorah, which Moshe set before the children of Israel, the testimonies, the statutes, the ordinances, which Moshe spoke to all of the Bnei Israel as they came forth out of Mitzrayim. And then it reminds us a little bit more about the history and where they are and what happened. And in chapter 5, says, Moshe then called to all Israel, said, here's the first of several times we're going to hear this particular terminology. We've already said it at least once tonight. Hear, O Israel, Shema Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I speak in your ear this day. Why? So that you may learn them and, what, observe to do them. Well, then, Yahuwah, our El, made a covenant with us in Horeb at Mount Sinai. He didn't make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us. Those are those of us who are alive this day. He spoke with you out of the fire. I, said Moshe, stood between he and you at that time to declare the word of Yahuwah. You were pretty well afeared because of the fire. And here's what he said. Here we're going to come upon the repetition of the Ten Devarim, the Ten Commandments. Anki Yahuwah Eloheka Asher, who brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other Elohim before my face. Literally, pani there. The root word is before my face. Pause. Anki Yahuwah. Sometimes it's Ani Yahuwah, sometimes it's Anki Yahuwah. But the three words at the beginning there are what's important. I am, in the English, Yod Heh Vav Heh. I am who I say I am. I have heard it said, and I really do like this, that if you're looking for a way to parse that first commandment, you could put a period there and get the gist of it. I am Yod Heh Vav Heh. The rest is explanation. And then there follows an if-then statement. Because I am who I say I am, well then what? You shall have no other Elohim before me. And then it says you're not to make a graven image, anything. We've heard this before in this portion. A likeness of anything that's in the heavens above earth beneath or the waters under the earth. Don't bow down to them and serve them, for I, Yahuwah, am a jealous Elohim, and I visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but show mercy unto the thousandth generation of them that love me and keep my commandments. You are not to take the name Hashem Yahuwah in vain, for he will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Then, observe. And it's literally that same word, shamar, the same root. Keep the Sabbath day, to separate it, to make it kadosh, set apart, as Yahuwah has commanded you. 6 days you do your labor, you do all your work. Seventh day is a Sabbath unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and in it you're not to do any manner of work, not you and your son, nor your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, your ox, your ass, any of your cattle, nor the stranger that is within your gates. Your manservant, your maidservant, they all rest with you. And remember, he says. Now, by the way, this is a little bit different. It's kind of instructive sometimes to do the comparisons, because they're almost, but not quite, word for word. Remember, too, that you were a servant in the land of Egypt, a slave. And Yahuwah Elohecha brought you out of there by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, Yahuwah commands you to keep the Sabbath day. Slightly different. And I saw a really interesting midrash. This one has stuck with me because I think it makes a lot of sense. You were a slave in Egypt, right? Now you're mine. You're my servant. Literally, he could have said, and it's kind of the implication here, I own you. You belong to me. We've seen mention of the Levites and the firstborn, things like that. But literally, in this case, I brought you out of bondage. Consider that. And then ask yourself, what is it that causes this particular association to be made with the Sabbath day? I mean, think of it. What does the Sabbath day, which, you know, most of Christianity ignores anyway, we keep the Lord's Sabbath now because the Pope said, years and years ago, Sun God Day is what really matters. Remember, it was Constantine, the sun god worshiper. And we so much appreciated that that we just said, heck with whatever it is that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh wants. We will now change that unilaterally. There's another kind of bondage here. The teaching that I'm referring to essentially says this. Look, and by the way, you can find this in the teachings of people like Shaul, Kepha, Peter, who called themselves bondservants of the Most High. And by the way, they never ever kept Sun God Day. They kept his Sabbaths. Not just the Sunday Sabbath. No, not at all the Sunday Sabbath. They kept his seventh day Sabbath. They also kept the high Sabbaths, if you want to use that terminology, the other feasts of Yah. But, okay, so why is it that there's this association with bondservants on the one hand and keeping this day of rest on the other? Because if we are his servants, and if we were in cruel bondage at one point, and that's what we're supposed to remember, and who it is that by a mighty hand brought us out of that, isn't it instructive that he says, therefore, look, here's what I'm asking you to do. One day a week. Just rest. It's literally a contrast written in the seventh day throughout time and space and history for us to remind us that we are not slaves in the cruel sense. We are bondservants to the Most High. And it's not busting our butts that matters to him. It's, I'm asking you to do this one simple thing. Remember my Sabbath, separate it, and rest. I mean, think of it that way. How hard is it to ask a bunch of people who have just come out of slavery and who need to remember that throughout their generations? I'm not asking you something really hard. I'm just asking you to take a rest and dedicate that day of no work and rest to me. How hard can that be? Wow. When you look at it that way, folks, it makes it seem ever so much more ridiculous that we've got people say, oh, you're bound by the law. I'm not under the law anymore. I don't have to rest anymore because that God that I don't care about. Come on. Literally. This is what is so. I listened to something this week. I heard a preacher, evangelical preacher, talking about how things are really ugly out there, and we need to all come together. And isn't it a shame people are forgetting the message, the important message, and they're focused on all kinds of trivial things, like, should we eat poison pork? He didn't put it that way. And, even more trivial, the Sabbath. Oh, excuse me. Excuse me for thinking, let God be true and every man a liar. But when the creator of the universe emphasizes over and over and over and over and over again, because we are so stinking full of ourselves, we can't do something as simple as remember, this day is my day. I brought you out of bondage, of slavery, and all I'm asking is, just keep my day separate. And we've got lying dipsticks like this tell us that's trivial. Well, excuse me, you take it up with him. He seems to think it's important enough to write it down and repeat it and tell us, listen, observe, keep, and do. And we got people saying, oh, that's trivial. Well, excuse me. Like I said, take it up with him. As you can guess, folks, this kind of stuff ought, I think, to make us mad. Can't we all just get along? Well, if you're going to call the God of the Bible a liar, the same guy was talking about blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, and I'm thinking, you're going to call him a liar and then tell other people about blasphemy of the Ruach HaKodesh? I won't even use that term. The Holy Ghost. Let's just read what he says and start by saying, keep my statutes, judgments, commandments, and do. And since I brought you out of bondage, it's not such a big deal to ask you just to remember which day of the week I told you to dedicate to me and to rest. All right. On to the honor your father and your mother as he has commanded you, that your days may be long and it may go well with you. Then we get these, kind of a set of three. They're practically one-worders. Lo tirzach. Lo, of course, means don't or no. No murder, literally, is what it says. Really, it's more like no slaying. Don't commit murder. Lo tirzach. Ve lo tinaf. Commit adultery. Without going into a lot of detail, just understand that adultery requires a married woman. If someone, I will contend, and this is a long discussion, but it's not that hard to go through and convince yourself. There's no such thing in the Bible as premarital sex. If a man takes a virgin, what he has done is one of two things. It's not premarital sex. It's either an attempt, subject to revocation by the father, at marriage, or it's whoring. If she's married, then it's adultery. You're not to steal, it says in the next one. Nor shall you bear false witness against your neighbor. Interesting that that would follow. Don't steal, don't bear false witness against your neighbor. If you think about it, what is it when you bear false witness against your neighbor? Yeah, it's Lashon Hara, or worse. You're stealing, literally, arguably, doing several of the things in this same verse. Stealing his good name. Stealing his righteousness, bearing false witness, it amounts to worse than that. It's literally murder of character, if you want to put it in those terms. Verse 17 says, nor shall you covet your neighbor's wife, lust after her, nor shall you desire, covet your neighbor's house, or basically all these other things that belong to him, his field, his manservant, his maidservant, his animals, his ox, his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's. His Bacco, his new Lexus, whatever it may be in the modern parlance. If it's his, you don't lust for it. because essentially, the way I understand this, and I'll point this out, and I think this is basically what the teaching that Yeshua does in the Sermon on the Mount brings home. Thought precedes action. Hebrew and all of the things in this Torah portion are very much action-oriented, doing-oriented words. We're to take this stuff to heart and understand that if we teach and speak, it is demonstrated by doing. Well, what is coveting? Coveting is an action verb too, and it ends up manifesting itself as these other things, as theft. So to the extent that when we're told don't covet, literally, it's don't steal. The steal process begins with coveting. And of course, if you want to look for an example of that, just look at a modern democracy where 51% of the people can vote to covet and therefore take away the life, liberty, and property of the other 49%. All right, says Moshe, these words Yahuwah spoke unto all of your assembly in that mountain out of the midst of the fire, the cloud, the thick darkness, with a great voice. He wrote all this stuff on two tablets of stone, gave them to me. And when you heard that voice out of the midst of the darkness, the mountain burned with fire, you came near, you sent all your representatives, your tribes, your elders, you said, whoa, he has shown us, Yahuwah has, his glorious greatness. We've heard his voice. We've seen this day that Elohim does speak with man and he lives. Now, therefore, why should we die? This has scared the you-know-what out of us. If we hear the voice of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, our God anymore, well, I think it'll kill us. We'll die. Who is there of all flesh that's heard the voice of the living Elohim speaking out of the midst of the fire as we have and lived? So, please, you go near, you listen, and you tell us in the future what it is that he's had to say. And so that will allow us to hear it secondhand and do it. Well, Yahuwah heard the voice of your words, and he said, I've heard the voice of these people. They've spoken unto you, and what they have said is well spoken. Oh, that they had such a heart as this always, to fear me, to keep my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. So, he told Moshe, tell them to go back to their tents. But as for you, stand here with me. I'll speak to you the commandments, the statutes, and the ordinances. You teach them, so they can go on the land and possess it. So, therefore, they will observe to do what has been commanded. Don't turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And then he says it again. Walk the way that you've been commanded, that you may live, that it may go well with you, and prolong your days in the land which you shall possess. Repetition, repetition. Tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them. Tell them to do it. And then tell them several times so they'll listen what you told them. Chapter 6 says, now here you go. Here is the statute, the commandments, the ordinances which Yahuwah has commanded you. You know what's coming next, right? That you may do them in the land you go over to possess. You might fear Yahuwah Eloheka and keep Shamar, all his statutes and commandments which I command you, and your son's son, all the days of your life, so that your days might be prolonged. Hear, therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it. I should have counted these up. Hear and do, statutes, judgments, and commandments, Shamar, hear and do. And then, of course, we get to verse 6. Now, you know this one. We've already repeated it once tonight. Shema Yisrael, Yahuwah Eloheka, Yahuwah Echad. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad. And you shall love Yahuwah Eloheka with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I command you, right? They'll be written upon your heart. Teach them. When you sit, when you walk, when you rise, when you lie down, bind them for a sign upon your hand. This is where the custom of the straps that you've seen wrapped around wrists and beyond the eyes comes from. And it shall be when Yahuwah brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, cities you didn't build, houses full of good things that you didn't fill up, cisterns you didn't have to dig out, vineyards and olive trees which you didn't plant. Well, you're going to eat and be satisfied. Beware, though, lest you would forget that Yahuwah, who brought you out of that land of Egypt, out of the hand of bondage, and you fail to fear him, and you begin to serve those others, well, you're not to go after those others, the gods of the peoples round about you. For he is a jealous Elohim. You wouldn't want the anger of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to be kindled against you, and he would destroy you from off of the face of the earth. Do not test or try Yahuwah Eloheka as you tried him in Massah. So what? So diligently keep Shamar the commandments, his testimonies, his statutes, which he commanded you, and do that it may be well with you. You can go in and possess that land, thrust out your enemies before you. There comes a time when your son's going to say to you, what does all this mean, these testimonies, these statutes, and the ordinances which he's commanded you? And you tell him the story. We were bondmen to Pharaoh. He brought us out, showed us all this stuff. And he showed Pharaoh and all of his house too, right before our eyes. And he brought us out. He gave us this land just as he swore he would do. And he then commanded us to do all of these statutes, to fear Yahuwah Eloheka for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. And it shall be righteousness. The root word there is zadik. Zadika unto us if we will observe and do all of these things. And we're going to basically wrap this up the way it began, with another indication about the land and the people that are going to be dispossessed and why, and therefore what it is that the bottom line that needs to be repeated so many times is. When Yahuwah brings you into this land that you go to possess, there's going to be all of these nations. This is Brad Scott's punchline here. The Hittite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, and the Muscovites, all these other little ites there, seven nations, greater and mightier than thou. And then when Yahuwah delivers them up before you, you are to smite them. Now here comes the part that a lot of people have a little difficulty stomaching. Why? Well, one of the explanations, and I'll admit, I can't prove this, but more and more I tend to think that there is some undeniable truth in it. Well, it evidently seems to be because maybe they just weren't quite fully human. In any case, there was, who knows, maybe it was the DNA. That's what we're being, as we look at the world today and see the manipulation that's going on, and we remember prophecies like as it was in the time of Noah, what could that mean? I can't argue with that. Very well might be. I don't teach it explicitly because I can't prove it from Scripture, but neither is it inconsistent. But what it does say is this: when he delivers them up before you, you are to utterly destroy them. Utterly destroy them. And we've seen what that means. Is this murder? Well, no, we've just been commanded. You are not to slay. But somehow or other, there's a very big difference here. Obviously, it is true that he is the one, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who is delivering them up before you. Oh, and it says the covenant with them. Cut no covenant with them. Make no treaty with the inhabitants of the land, nor are you to show mercy unto them. You don't want your bloodlines polluted either. Don't make marriages with them. If that's not clear, your daughter is not to be given to his son, nor are you to take his daughter unto your son. Why? Well, that will end up turning away your sons from following me, that they end up serving other gods. And that will in turn kindle his anger against you, and he'll destroy you quickly. So what are we supposed to do here? It's real clear, and I will contend that at least the essential element of this message ought to resonate with us today, especially when we consider the so-called church and what's happened. I saw an excellent piece just this week from Chuck Baldwin about how the church has failed. You know, it's bought into the Romans 13 lie. When Big Brother says jump, you say how high. It's bought into the 501c3 church lie. Basically, the pulpits have failed to ring with righteousness. They have failed to teach stuff that over and over and over again gets repeated, just like we're trying to teach and repeat it tonight. Observe, keep, shamar my statutes, my commandments, my judgments, my testimonies, and do, 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 do. And the irony, of course, is as much as I thought that was a good piece by Chuck Baldwin, it falls short. Why do I say that? Well, I think it's clear. Because even during the time of the founders, when the pulpits were a heck of a lot more righteous than they are today, they still weren't keeping his Sabbaths. Now, true, most of the United States 200 years ago hadn't yet been polluted by paganism to the extent that it has today, but the roots were already still there. We're still in the process, in other words, of coming back and coming out and purging all of this stuff out of us. And here is why. Because they failed to do what chapter 7, verse 5 of Deuteronomy says right here. Here is how you should have dealt with them, but you didn't. You were to break down their altars, dash in pieces their pillars, hew down their asherim, and burn their graven images with fire. Now, I've got my Hebrew text here with these action verbs in the Hebrew highlighted. Titotsu, break down. Shabar, hew down, dash in pieces, burn. Seraph, right? Burn their graven images with fire. The implication here is real clear. If we're supposed to literally utterly destroy the paganism, make no covenant with them, because it'll end up causing real problems, and what was supposed to have been done was just literally purge all of that paganism utterly. And it didn't happen. Well, we're still seeing the problems that come from that. Why? Well, because it says you are a set apart people unto Yahuwah Eloheka. He has chosen you to be his own treasure out of all the peoples that are upon the face of the earth. Now, here's one of those places where I'm going to basically, because I've been picking on the Catholic extreme side of the house, I will also pick a little bit on the Southern Kingdom and its descendants. Got both kingdoms, Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom, both failed on this score. Both ended up in exile. And when I see this, and I'll admit, this kind of tends to irritate me a little bit. It'd say, well, the Jewish people are the holy people that God has chosen, the chosen people, to be his own treasure out of all the peoples that are upon the face of the earth. Well, excuse me, and no offense to those that are of the tribe of Judah, or even the southern kingdom, Judah, Benjamin, some Levites. But let's be real here. Kol Israel was 12 tribes. All of the sons of Yaakov, Judah was just one of them. Ephraim, Manasseh, they may serve as a surrogate. Okay, we'll hear him talk about Judah and Ephraim, you know, the two main groupings. But let's be clear about this, because this too is another way that we fall into this division. You know, if you're not Jewish, you don't keep the Torah. You don't have to keep the Sabbath. Oh, excuse me, where does it say that? What this says in verse 6 is, you are to be a set-apart people unto Yahuwah Eloheka, because he has chosen you to be his own treasure out of all the peoples that are upon the face of the earth. Do we want to be grafted into that house or not? Caleb was. Do we know what our heritage is? In most cases, as I've already been talking about, we don't necessarily know. But we know that the invitation is open, come ye who will. We know that the proof and the promise of Scripture was that these peoples have been scattered through every nation, tribe, and tongue. It's a virtual lead pipe sense that regardless of whether you're red, yellow, black, or white, you have the blood of some of these people flowing in you. But even that isn't nearly as important as whether you have a heart to follow him and want to be grafted in, want to be one of these people. You can, in fact, then be a holy people unto Yahuwah Eloheka. You don't have to be Jewish, in other words. You don't have to be part of the one true Catholic Universal Church either. All you got to do is come out of the paganism and learn that there's a whole lot of paganism out there that needs to be purged from us. May it be that we choose and work to Shamar, to keep his statutes and judgments, and to do them, and to be a set-apart people unto him. Verse 7 says, he didn't set his love upon you, nor choose you, because there were so many of you, and you were more numerous than all these other folks. Well, you were, in fact, pretty few in number. It was because he loved you, and because he would keep the covenant, the oath, the vow, which he swore unto your fathers. For those reasons, he brought you out of bondage with a mighty hand and redeemed you out of the house of bondage from the hand of Pharaoh. If he redeemed you again, what's your rightful service, right? To be a bondservant to the Most High. Keep his statutes, his commandments. Even do the trivial things, as some would say, like keeping his Sabbaths. And by the way, if you don't want to be cursed, might be a good thing to avoid eating stuff that he says is not food, like pig. Does that mean it's trivial? No. But if you don't want to be poisoned, that might be important to some folks. Anyway, oh, and those diseases of Egypt, right, that we can begin to see out there on the horizon. So therefore know that Yahuwah, your Eloheka, he is Elohim, the faithful, the covenant keeper. He has mercy on those that love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations. And he repays those that hate them to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack with them that hate him. He will repay him to his face. Now, I'm going to talk about the news in just a couple of minutes. We're about ready to pause. But I do think that is an important warning as we look out on a nation that literally hates him, doesn't let him into its schools, has the 9 black robe priests of another god who basically came down with a decree and said, we, in our almighty wisdom, we will license and define marriage. We will tell you what is legal. We will tell you which god you must serve. We will define your business. Hell, we'll take away your business if you got a license from us and you don't like the way your god tells you you had better behave. I'm going to suggest, hey, he knows their hearts, I don't. I know their actions. I see by their words and their deeds which gods they serve. And hint, hint, it clearly is not Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. There's a warning here. Those who hate them, those who hate him, he will not be slack to them. He will repay them to their faces. How about those of us that heed that warning? Verse 11 says, therefore, you, and you can pretty well say it with me, right? It's been repeated and repeated. Therefore, you are to shamar, keep, the commandments and the statutes and the ordinances, the mitzvot, ha-hukim, ve-ha-mishpatim, which I command you this day to do them. And with that, we come to the end of the portion. But I guess when all is said and done, folks, you can summarize most of this in about 3 words. Keep, statutes, judgments. Throw in commandments if you want. There's 4. And then, of course, if you're keeping them, what does that mean? There's the 5th word. Do. So let's take just a couple minutes and talk about what the heck is going on in the world. Because, again, we are supposed to be like the men of Issachar, I will contend, who knew the times and the seasons, so they knew what Israel should do. We're not supposed to be caught unaware. Proverbs tells us that the prudent man sees danger coming, and he hides himself. He takes precautions. He is prepared. He knows what's going on. And, of course, part of that and part of the reason why this is so important now is because we need to make sure we know who we serve. And if we take to heart all of the things in this this Torah portion, probably one of the most central, I think, in terms of literally laying out. Well, it's got the great commandment. It's got the 10 Deborim all in one part, and it keeps emphasizing, hear, obey, and do. What? All of these things that he has laid out for us, if we're his. So let's start with some of the things in the news that pretty well make that clear. And I'm actually going to work up to some of the things that are downright shocking this week, because I will tell you, as dramatic as the news has been over the last weeks and months, and the more dramatically it seems to be building towards some kind of a climax, this was a big one, and probably not for reasons that most people have even heard. So here we go. Let's start with the easy stuff that just simply says, hey, you want proof that the creator of the universe isn't welcome anymore? The state of Kentucky is doubling down on licensed pastors. Well, in this case, they have counselors that are allowed to go into the place where the pagans send people, right? Remember, jail is a very much a pagan thing, not sanctioned by Torah. But the state of Kentucky does have volunteer pastor counselors that it deigns to let into its slaveholding facilities. And they have now decided that the Department of Juvenile Justice, and I'm not going to name this blankety-blank, who is, quote, seeking to protect the rights of all youth in its care and custody, regardless of what their committing offense was or their sexual orientation. Now, notice the irony in that. They seek to protect the rights of all their youth. How are they going to do that? By making damned sure that they don't hear anything from the God that they don't allow. Yod Heh Vav Heh. To that end, it says, and I'm quoting, the department prohibits its staff and volunteers from discriminating against youth based on sexual orientation or gender identity. That means that they're going to prohibit the biblically literate from even being allowed to counsel those folks. And they're getting rid of them. BSA, probably no longer stands for Boy Scouts of America anymore. This week they decided that it's just great. Let's have some gay counselors. Hey, maybe we can get a little bit more scouts inducted into the homosexual lifestyle. Get them while they're young. Isn't that what they say? You know what, folks? This kind of stuff really does disgust me. One more comment from this Kentucky story. The DJJ, the Department of Juvenile Sick Justice, says this week that their requirements to not allow anybody to come in there and say that homosexuality is sinful. Get this. They were ordered, all of the an oath promising to refrain from telling any juveniles in this system that homosexuality is, quote, sinful. And they claim that all of this is, quote, rooted in the federal requirements of the Prison Rape Elimination Act. Get that. Prison Rape Elimination Act. So where are these kids most likely to be gang raped? Yeah, you know the answer yourself. Got another story here. Okay, let me see here. Am I working up to this now? Yeah, we'll do this one now. I want to ask a question or two. I'm going to ask a couple questions tonight because I'm really, really curious. I know that the folks that are listening here hardly represent a cross-section of the American public, and I'm very thankful for that. But let me ask it this way. If I said the words Cecil the Lion, give me a 1 if you have a clue what I'm talking about, a 2 if you don't. And we'll pause. Cecil the Lion. Oh, no. I knew this. Are there any 2s? Anybody out there has not heard about Cecil the Lion? Anybody here in the room hasn't heard about Cecil the Lion? 2s? Okay, got 1! And I guess it's because at movie night last night, he didn't hear the discussion at the front of the room about Cecil the Lion. That's where I heard about it, folks. I haven't tuned in a Waystream TV show or news report. It goes like this. Some of you probably already know what I'm going to say. I saw a story today. And it was actually it was a good story. It was written by somebody that was saying, for crying out loud, the death of outrage in America. You heard me talk about this last week. You got Planned Parenthood, that is literally executing babies. Hey, we're fine with that, right? America loves the sacrament of late-term abortion. They're fine with the tens of millions that have been killed. No problem there. Take our tax dollars. Sure, we're good little slaves of the state. We're happy to subsidize abortion. Now, a few people got a little bit upset when they found out that somebody was profiting from the sale of baby parts. Kill them, that's fine. But sell the parts and profit because I want a Lamborghini? No, just maybe they've crossed the line. All right? The story that that this particular author was pointing out was the death of outrage. Most people, they don't really get too upset about it. Some were a little bit upset. The White House basically came out and said, well, they defended Planned Parenthood. They're not going to allow anything to be done to quit the gravy train on that story. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Y'all have already heard about Cecil the Lion. Some dentist from Minnesota paid $54,000 to go halfway around the world to Zimbabwe and shoot a lion with a crossbow. The lion's name was Cecil, and it might have been under pretty shady circumstances. No argument there. But I'll tell you what, America squealed like a stuck pig. Kill a million babies? No problem. Subsidize it? Oh yeah, we're fine with that. But somebody shot a lion and harvested its head? What baby part? You killed Cecil the Lion. That guy needs dying. I saw people saying this was the most evil, despicable man in America. PETA demanded his head on a plate. Deborah Messing, redheaded actress in TV, was on there saying, boy, basically, he deserves all kinds of evil stuff. Jimmy Kimmel Live roasted him on TV, disparaged his manhood, and said, well, all kinds of nasty stuff. Oh, you know, I mean, let's get our perspectives in order here, right? A few dead babies, not even newsworthy. Selling some baby parts, well, if there's profit involved, now we're concerned. But somebody goes overseas and kills a lion? The lion would have killed you, probably, as has been pointed out, given the chance. Now America is outraged. Is there anything wrong with this picture? Something is horribly wrong here. I mean, literally. When you see this and you step back and you think about it, you just got to shake your head. So, lion parts, how dare you? Baby parts, what else is on TV? Let's talk about economics just for a second. We're working our way up to the big stuff. I'm seeing some comments on the screen. Because honestly, folks, I saw the story. It was not on any of the news sites that I frequent for news. It probably was on the Daily Mail. I occasionally look at some of the British papers and stuff, but I genuinely don't go to MSNBC or CBS or that kind of thing. If the aggregators that I look at have a link, then I will see them. But honestly, I heard about Cecil the Lion. I didn't even hear it was Cecil the Lion. I just heard that there was some dentist involved in something that was upsetting to some folks. And, didn't spend any time on the story. All right. Economics. Number of things this week. One, Greece has literally devolved to a barter economy. China tried to open up its markets, and they literally tanked. Remember, the Chinese have now manipulated the market even to a greater extent and more openly than a Big Brother Plunge Protection Team in America does. They essentially told people, if you dare to sell stocks, we will hang you from your own petard. And when they tried to open the markets, it was ugly. But, not to worry, the yuan is still on track to be the world reserve currency, according to the other stuff that's going on. Here's a piece from Gregory Manarino, and he's a stock trader and expert. I kind of like him and a number of other folks. But what he wrote this last week was entertaining. He said, something horrible is coming. Yes, it's a mathematical certainty. Look at China, that's just the latest proof of it, that when a government or central bank or all of the above attempts to prop up or fix a market, it is doomed to fail. We've seen that. Yep, no doubt. There is absolute proof now that governments do not fix problems. They only make them worse by intervening. What's happening in China is proof positive. The worst part of all of this, though, he wrote, is that this global debt crisis, which we're in the middle of right now, also cannot be fixed by any intervention of central banks colluding with governments. Further, a terrible price, says Manarino, is going to be forced upon the citizenry of the world because of these actions. The only job of markets is to determine fair market value, and when governing bodies of any kind attempt to interfere with that process, that mechanism, only disaster will come from it. John Crudell, New York Post, reported that stock market rigging has no longer a conspiracy theory. It's been obvious for quite some time. Even Ed Yardeni, longtime Wall Street guru, says these markets are rigged. I don't say that as a criticism, just factually. This was on NBC recently. And what the horrible thing is that's coming down, says Manarino, is a global financial meltdown. So, well, you know, all of you listening here have heard that for quite some time. I just think it's more interesting that more and more people, even in more and more of the waste stream, is coming out and pretty well admitting it. This one, too. Another on the admission scale. Some of you may know who a fellow named Nassim Taleb is. He wrote a very famous now book called The Black Swan a few years back. He predicted the 2008 financial crisis as a, and not only that, he became a very wealthy man as a result of having predicted first the crash of 87 and then the 2008 crisis. He is a distinguished professor now of risk engineering at NYU and has written several bestsellers. Basically, what he has been talking about is the mathematics of risk. And he did a really great job in this book of talking about what are called fat tails and Six Sigma events, all kinds of things that statisticians will point to. It's kind of fascinating. But a black swan basically has become a popular metaphor as a result of his book. And it means something that shouldn't, ought to happen. But when it does, Katie, bar the door. You know, it was a black swan. Who could have thought it? That brought down the stock market. It's a black swan that is going to bring down the world's entire markets. And the problem, and the point he makes is, you know, predicting when a black swan will show up might be really difficult, but predicting that one will eventually show up as a lead pipe cinch. Well, he is now talking about, with another author too, another black swan event that has become a lead pipe certainty. Now, you may find this interesting. He said you've got a whole bunch of so-called scientists that are literally boosters, cheerleaders for genetically modified frankenfoods, for GMOs. And he points out that just as lots of people that are in the stock markets are ignorant of financial analysis and risk, so are these so-called scientists ignorant of risk analysis for what they're doing too. And he said, literally, proliferation of GMOs could lead to, quote, an irreversible termination of life on the planet. And I got to read a couple of paragraphs here because this kind of sets up some of the other things that are really, really important this week. None of this got much press. Hey, Cecil the Lion, remember? Only thing that really matters. Before the crisis started in 2007, he wrote, he and his co-author, let's see, who's the co-author? It's in here somewhere. Mark Spitznagel. He also made lots of money on the stock market crash because he predicted it too. They wrote for the New York Times that before this crash in 2007, both of us believed that the financial system was fragile and unsustainable, contrary to the universal opinion at the time. But now, there is something, they wrote, which is vastly riskier that's facing us. These risks entail the survival of the entire global ecosystem, not just the financial system. This time the fight is against the current promotion of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. Critics of the financial system thesis we came out with said that thanks to the unwavering progress of science and technology, which had blessed finance, because we're all so damn smart, don't you know, with more sophisticated economic insight, why, nothing could possibly ever go wrong. But what they call the tail risks, the effect from rare but monstrously consequential events, we held, has been increasing, owing to the increasing level of complexity and globalization. So given that almost nobody was paying any attention to those risks, we set ourselves and our clients, hey, they did the Solomon thing, to be prudent, to be protected from the eventual collapse of the banking system, which eventually happened. We were prepared. And we were repeatedly told there was evidence the system was stable. We were in the great moderation. But the problem is, for a solution to, well, basically what they said is, you really want to make something stable, it needs to be like the restaurant business. Decentralized, where mistakes stay local, and they can't bring down the entire system. And what they point out is that these GMO cheerleaders are making the same mistakes with the same anti-scientific arguments as those who were so wrong about the stability of the financial system then and again now. That one collapsed, but it was only money. Now we're facing the same five fallacies that we cautioned against when it comes to the popularity of GMOs. And by the way, they note nearly 80% of all food in the U.S. contains these Frankenfoods. That's my term, folks. First, there's been this tendency, if you don't like GMOs, to be labeled anti-science. You put people in the same category as those who are anti-vaccine. Even call them Luddites. Of course, there's nothing scientific about the comparison, nor is the scholastic invention of a so-called consensus valid when it comes to science either. But they are a lot like snake oil salesmen. And he harkens back to the snake oil salesman of the last century. Well, century before last now. Second, we're told that a modified tomato is really not any different from a naturally occurring tomato, the kind that God made. That's wrong. The statistical mechanism is very much different. In nature, errors stay confined. And critically, they stay isolated. It's almost like there was a design there, if you think about it. Third, technological salvation that we faced in finance is also present with GMOs. They're going to save the children by providing them with vitamin-enriched rice, but the argument's flaw is obvious. In a complex system, we don't know what causes what, so it's better to solve a problem by the simplest method than to pick one which is perhaps likely to cause a bigger problem. Fourth, there's this thing they call monoculture. Monoculture. And the example that they give, if you don't know what that means, is, well, in Ireland, there was monoculture. The whole country basically was dependent, right prior to something called the potato famine, on a single crop, the potato. So when a single crop suffered a single system-wide failure, the whole country fell into famine. So imagine what happens if that could be planetary in nature. So he says it's been accepted for years and for decades even, when all farmers in a certain region, like in Ireland, grow the same strain of the same crop, this is monoculture, the crops themselves become more susceptible. Why? Because any bug or insect or germ which happens to like them and attack them can take out the whole crop and bring down all the farms at the same time. How about if there's a single kind of grasshopper that loves corn? If everybody grows the same kind of corn, we could have a problem. However, if we have polyculture, different kinds of crops, the pest might get some of them, but others would survive. So he says this GMO experiment carried out now worldwide in real time with our entire food chain and ecological system as its laboratory is perhaps the greatest case of human hubris in history. It creates yet another systemic too big to fail, and of course Monsanto's too big to jail enterprise, one for which there will be no bailout possible, like they did with the financial system. Didn't fix it, remember, just put off the day of reckoning, when it ultimately fails. So basically what they say is, wow, this is a pretty amazing thing. Be aware that what is being done here is setting up the entire world crop system for the potential of a massive failure. Decreased yield, it's already being shown up, increased requirements for pesticide, the absence of any real safety studies, and all kinds of other nasty stuff that may come along with it. This week, the House of Representatives, the so-called opposition, decided to give the imperial office the ability to take people's passports without trial and without recourse. Give me some ones. Did you hear about this story? This was a vote on something called H.R. 237, the Foreign Terrorist Organization Passport Revocation Act. So twos if you didn't hear about it. Basically what it says is now the Secretary of State, if he doesn't like some, you know, conservative, constitutional, libertarian, or Christian, or whatever the case may be, can just take away their passport. It's just exactly like what happened in, oh, I don't know, Soviet Russia, Nazi Germany, you name it, behind the Iron Curtain. So now they can basically take away people's passport. It didn't even pass, by the way, on a recorded vote because the House declared that it was so uncontroversial. We'll take away your right to travel out of a formerly free country and Sovietize America. And it was not worthy of news coverage, nor was it even worthy of debate. They just took a voice vote and said, yeah, it's done. We love Obama so much, we'll give him the right to take away your passport. Oh, guess what? When they take away your passport, there's no recourse, no appeal. I guess it's okay, because if they can kill you with a drone, why can't they take away your passport too? All that, folks, leads me to this. Now, here's another one I'm going to ask. I'll ask these two words, and I know we're a little bit long tonight, but I think this is something, if you haven't heard it, I know it's, well, it's downright disgusting. It's more important than Cecil the Lion. If I said GCMAF, give me a 1 if you've heard the term and you know what I'm getting ready to say, a 2 if you don't. 1 if you know what GCMAF is and what I'm heading to, 2 if you don't. And then this one, if I said Nagalase, same thing. 1 if you've heard it, 2 if you don't. I'm guessing that the 1s and 2s are going to be the same here. And I'm looking for any 1s. Wow. Almost like Cecil the Lion. Cecil the Lion did his job. Cecil the Lion successfully managed to keep people from hearing about A, the trivial thing of a bunch of babies being harvested for parts, and B, something that is arguably, and I'm going to say it, folks, even more important and damnable. Why? Because this is the smoking gun. The story goes like this. Now, you may have heard about the second item. Let me just, we'll do this in kind of a sequence here. Give me a 1 if you heard about the dead doctors epidemic, particularly in Florida. So, 1 if you've heard about the dead doctors. And I know Lumi down there in Florida may have heard about them. Okay. There have been, last I heard, we were up to maybe 10 of them. At least 5 killed, and then later on it turned out, no, 8 of them have shown up dead, and there's still a bunch missing. Probably at the head of the class, say what? 13. Oh, we're up to 13, Lumi? Okay. I hadn't heard that. Of course, I hadn't looked at it for an update in a couple of days. Probably the one that was at the head of the crop here was a fellow named Dr. James Jeffrey Bradstreet. And he was found shot dead floating in a river. But just a few days before that, U.S. government agents, feds, had raided his research facility in order to seize his research and this thing, which most people haven't heard of, a protein called GCMAF. All right, now this sounds fairly complex, and it's intended to be. And, of course, if you can kill all the doctors that know what's going on, it can stay complex and hidden for a lot longer, I guess. But it goes something like this. And if you want more information, I would encourage people. I did a long story on Monday, and I actually repeated it in the news today. We'll probably play it again tomorrow. But it goes like this. GCMAF is a protein. And it is a vital part of our immune system, at least it was, back when many of us had immune systems. It is an anti-cancer agent, yeah, but more importantly, it is involved in the way the body processes vitamin D3, which comes from sunlight. The immune system literally does not work without it. It's part of a normal person's bloodstream, and it's produced by a healthy immune system all the time. Since 1990, says the story I'm looking at here, 59 research papers have been published on GCMAF. 20 of those have to do with cancer treatments, and a lot of them, there's even a GCMAF website. But it turns out that there's another thing which is associated with this same process. It's called Nagalase. Now, what is Nagalase? Nagalase is a protein which is kind of like the opposite, in a way, and I'm putting it a little bit crudely here, of GCMAF. GCMAF is inhibited by the presence of this protein called NAGLase. It's a protein blocker. It's an enzyme that is also coincidentally produced by cancer cells and viruses. Well, now you see how this begins to work. Cancer cells and viruses don't want the immune system to take them out. So they produce NAGLase to try to block the GCMAF from doing what God designed it to do, which is to kill, to take out cancers and viruses and things that threaten a person's body. Imagine, if you will, right, submitted for your approval, if somebody was evil enough to figure out a way to get this NAGLase thing put in all kinds of vaccines. Isn't that clever? Turns out that Dr. Bradstreet has treated, before he was untimely executed, 1,100 patients with GCMAF. Now, you could actually, there's a protein, the protein has actually been synthesized. I guess it's available in Europe. At least in Europe, they still think that there's such a thing as medical freedom, and they're encouraging research on this because GCMAF literally probably comes as close as anything you will hear to the conspiracy theory cure for cancer. Therefore, of course, it is utterly verboten in the no longer free United States of America. Now, you know why it was that they killed this guy? Evidently. Hey, do we know that that's the case? No. The wet workers do a pretty good job of covering their tracks. They've killed a whole bunch of folks. A lot of them look like suicides, heart attacks, you name it. Just coincidences. That allows the news media to ignore all of this. So here's where the plot thickens, folks. There are a couple of things that are wrong here. Mike Adams points this out. In the last few days, before we learned that he was found dead, shot in the chest, floating in the river, pioneering medical researcher Dr. Bradstreet was working with GCMAF. Turns out it may be the universal cancer cure for many people. It has also been shown, get this, to reverse autism in the vast majority of patients. You got a lot of kids that are coming down with autism. Where are they getting it? Ah, isn't that an amazing coincidence? Perhaps from some of those very same vaccine shots with these viruses. In other words, what some are suggesting is Bradstreet and those who were working with him were very close to coming up with the smoking gun and saying, you know what? You know what? There seems to be a connection here between the good protein that is not allowed in the United States and the evil bad protein that is associated with autism and all kinds of other nasty stuff. You name it, Epstein-Barr disease, HIV, cancers of all kinds and stripes. And there's NAGLase present. Well, so autism was treated by Dr. Bradstreet. He had 1,100 patients with GCMAF treatments. He had an 85% positive response rate, which is pretty darned impressive. Total eradication was achieved in about 1 out of 6 patients. And there were all kinds of other powerful anti-cancer effects with significant therapeutic impact on most tumors, including breast, prostate, kidney, and so forth and so on. Well, you know we can't have that, right? So somebody deep-sixed him. His death seems highly suspicious, as does that of many other holistic doctors recently found dead under similar circumstances. Another guy who's done some papers in the same area, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, died just a couple of days ago. So here's what Mike Adams, writing about this earlier this week, said. He says, is there a motive for killing all these cancer researchers possibly working on this universal cure for cancer? Of course. It's the most common motive in the world, money. And he says a cancer cure that is this efficacious would destroy the highly lucrative cancer industry and collapse things like the American Cancer Society, all kinds of hospitals, oncology clinics, and pharmaceutical companies that depend on continuing revenues from things like chemotherapy to stay profitable. So, yeah, there's a reason. I'm going to suggest again, and this, by the way, also came out through the Hagman & Hagman report. They did a nice job. They had Ted Brewer on a special session a week ago, Shabbat, talking about this. And he was drawing the conclusions. A lot of these doctors are very scared at this point. They're supposed to be. And essentially what they're saying is it just possible that this is a hell of a lot more insidious even than killing tens of millions of babies and calling it a national sacrament? Yeah. California just passed a universal mandate You want to put your kids in the indoctrination centers? Tell them to bend over and take one. We're going to poke them with maybe Nagalays. There is all kinds of evidence already accumulating that says that these vaccines, while they may provide some temporary relief from the symptoms of some of these things, the long-term effects aren't good. There's clearly an incredible increase in autism. Is it just possible, in other words, that somebody's doing this on purpose? And that seems to be the real reason for a bunch of dead doctors. Just maybe the smoking gun is, it's not only about preventing a cure for cancer, it's about giving people injections to destroy their immune systems, make them prone to autism and cancers and all kinds of other stuff, and therefore a hell of a lot easier to kill. This is incredibly nasty. And it may be one of the biggest and most, guess what, underreported stories in recent memory. Nasty, insidious stuff. You know, it's not the first time we've seen things like this. What was the fellow that wrote the, I'm trying to think of the name. We've got a couple of his books up at the house. The fact that HIV may have been an engineered virus, that Ebola was almost certainly bioengineered, that weapons research... Dr. Lynn Horowitz. Yeah, so this is not a new thesis. I mean, this is around and has been talked about openly for quite some time. The difference here is the actual indication of a genuine smoking gun, a direct protein link, where they can say, look, these things are being injected into kids and they're coming down with autism. We've seen the statistical connection for years. That's the reason why a whole bunch of people that care about their kids are saying, no, I don't want to poison them. I don't want to see this put to them. But now it's serious enough that there's a bunch of dead doctors as a result of it. And we're not done yet. Got this one. Let me ask you about this one. Yeah, the teaching dead doctors don't lie. There's a bunch of them. Again, this is not new. What the news is here is that the smoking gun literally is still warm to the touch. So I'll ask one more. If I said fluoride in water doesn't prevent even cavities, did you hear that story this week? Now, if you knew that, and a lot of people already knew that, give me a 2. But if you heard the story, because the story actually came out in Newsweek, and it's actually, it was last month's Newsweek. But what's interesting is now there's Aspen, Snowmass area, finally decided as a result of this to defund the fluorine program. They're no longer going to put the fluoride in the water. So here's I think, an amazing confluence of events. All right? Fluoride, as a lot of people are aware, is a byproduct of nuclear waste preparation. You want to produce uranium for the enrichment programs for atomic weapons research. A byproduct is a lot of something called uranium hexafluoride. Well, it's a nasty, caustic chemical. Costs a fortune to dispose of this toxic waste. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do if you got tons and tons and tons of a deadly neurotoxin? You know the answer, right? Sell it to cities all across the country and get them to feed it to school kids. Aren't we clever? We'll destroy their immune systems. We will reduce their IQ. Studies have shown that fluoride in the water will reduce IQ. Well, that makes them better voters, more amenable to being taught the crap we're going to teach them in the public cesspools anyway. A lot more docile, easier to control. Folks, fluoride is one of the nastiest poisons you can name. And it's being put in drinking water. Why? Oh, because it prevents cavities. So get this. What we have is a situation where America is more concerned about Cecil the Lion. They are dead babies. And they'd a lot rather have kids with healthy-looking teeth than functioning brains. I think there's a connection there. And the Newsweek piece says, oh, new study shows fluoride doesn't even prevent cavities. So it is a neurotoxin. It will kill you. It will destroy your immune system and reduce your child's IQ notably. And it doesn't even prevent cavities. But hey, says Newsweek, not to worry. we need to study it a little bit more before we decide whether we want to quit putting that toxic waste in the water. Hey, what else are we going to do with it? This is where we are. And now this leads us to the stuff that's really out there. There were stories this week about MAVs, micro air vehicles, allegedly being deployed and tested now in the field in Afghanistan. What are MAVs? These are little tiny dronelets. Now, you can go out for $20. And you can buy a little quadcopter that'll fit in the palm of your hand and fly it around with radio control. They're cute. I've got a couple of them. And they're fun to fly. And the technology is downright incredible. I said this before. As a servo engineer, I look at the little teeny motors and the little teeny gyroscopes and servos. These are incredible works of technology. And I guarantee you, if you can buy one for $20 that will fit in the palm of your hand, the Pentagon can buy 10,000 of them for, $10,000 a piece. We print the money. Big deal, right? Who cares how much they cost? That will fit on the thumb of your hand. Now, what else could you do with something that small? I know. You could put in a little bit of polonium-210. You could put on some kind of a neurotoxin. Heck, you could put Nagalase in it. All right? You could basically create little teeny wasp-sized things, maybe smaller for all we know, deploy them en masse, and kill anybody that won't comply with whatever it is you want them to comply with. This is not science fiction. This is something that is demonstrably current technology. And then we've got story after story about people like Dr. Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and others coming forth and saying the biggest threat facing humanity, well, GMOs, that's a pretty good one too. But no, maybe it's artificial intelligence. Autonomous killer robots. Tonight's Torah portion, thou shalt not slay. Well, I know what we'll do, because we got problems. We got soldiers that sometimes balk at orders to kill mass numbers of, say, Americans if you want to disarm them. How can you solve that problem? What can we do? I know! We'll just program a bunch of autonomous killer MAVs with various kinds of little shape charges. Send out swarms hither to not just harass our people and eat out their substance, but attack them and blow their little heads off. You want to commit mass murder on a global scale? The technology is now easy. And I'm going to suggest to you that if you connect the dots, it looks something like this. We got a land that could care less about killing millions of babies and harvesting their parts. They're a lot more concerned about one lion half a world away. There's an evil we can relate to and demonize that guy. Probably because he's got money and can afford to go do something we would say is stupid. Throw it away. $54,000 it cost him. So we're willing to put up with that kind of thing. In other words, we're willing to see tens of millions killed and we don't bat an eyelash. We turn a blind eye. We don't even hear about the injection of hundreds of millions worldwide, potentially, with something which can destroy their immune system and make them easy prey for all of the various diseases that the Bible says were going to come upon those who have forgotten him. Well, okay. Now what? Well, how much of a leap is it to say that, well, if they're willing to kill doctors who have figured that out and are beginning to come up with a potential cure, and we're already deploying weapons that can kill en masse and be mass-produced, and they're little tiny things, and they're cheap even, we'll bring the production price down to the point where we can afford to kill all kinds of folks. We got lots and lots of ways of committing mass murder and genocide. Is it much of a leap to say Jeremiah had it right? Jeremiah chapter 17, the human heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? So again, this is where we are, folks. The portion tonight ends with these words. I'm going to read them one more time. Chapter 17, Deuteronomy, verse 11. It says, actually, I think it's verse 10. What's happening here? I'm in the wrong place in the book. It was 27. That's a problem.
Not 17. 7. Chapter 7, verse 11. There we go.
We, those of us who choose to walk in obedience, are supposed to therefore keep His commandments, His statutes, His ordinance, which are commanded to us to do them. All right? Great. How about those who, well, lust, to commit murder, to covet people's stuff, to bear false witness? Literally, they come but to kill and destroy. Know therefore that Yahuwah, He is El, the faithful who keeps covenant, mercy with them that love Him and keep His commandments to a thousand generations. But, here's the warning. To those that hate Him to their face, He will destroy them. He will not be slack. To him that hates Him, He will repay him to his face. I think it's important for us to make sure we choose sides at this point, to be aware of the times and the seasons, and make darn sure we know who we serve and who we don't. So come out of her and be very, very well aware of it. Folks, I wish this was this is good news. The good news is, look up, for your redemption draws nigh. The good news is, literally, we are seeing things come to pass that people have been preparing for and warning about. The bad news is, there are going to be a whole lot of people that will die. That may include a number of us. Don't sweat that. The important part is to make sure that we know who we serve and that we're walking in obedience to that, to Him and to Him alone. And to try to avoid the fallout from those who are so clearly not. So, we will pray. And let's start with a prayer right now. And if you've got other prayer requests, praise reports, this is the time to put those on the screen too. So, Abba, we come before You. And we know that things look really bleak, because there is truly massive evil in the world. Abba, it's so much so, well, the human heart is desperately wicked. We read the verses. We know that this is true. But even so, the level, the intensity, the depravity of the evil and of those who hate You to Your face, it's repugnant to us, Father. It's so big that sometimes we just can't really believe that it could possibly be true. So we pray that You would give us eyes to see and ears to hear, that You'd help us to speak Your truth boldly, and to walk in obedience, and to hear and obey and teach Your commandments and do them, and to separate ourselves. Protect us in this time of trouble. And heal our houses too, Abba, and our communities. This we ask in Your name. We thank You and we praise You. Hallelujah. Amen.